Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 3rd. This week I'll be joined again by Father Jim Martin and Bill McGarvey from BustedHalo.com to discuss There Will Be Blood and Atonement. Last week we discussed the other Best Picture nominees, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and Juno, and you can find that online at americamagazine.podbean.com. So without further ado, let's get started. All right, well, we've got two more to go here, and we're going to jump back into another bleak movie with There Will Be Blood, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Epic film, has been lauded everywhere as sort of a classic American film. People have been comparing it to Citizen Kane. Jim, what was your take on it?
Well, I did go in there reading all these reviews saying it was a masterpiece and an epic. I thought it was terrific. I pay a lot of attention to the cinematography. I thought, for one thing, the music was spectacular. And you will know this fellow from Radiohead.
Johnny Greenwood.
They did a great job with kind of this dissonant soundtrack, investing scenes that would really have very little emotion to them, you know, like Daniel Day-Lewis sort of, you know, walking across a field with this tremendous sense of foreboding and danger. I thought it really was, in a sense, almost like a Greek tragedy. I think that was its strength and its weakness. I think the strength is that it's a terrific story, and basically Daniel Day-Lewis represents capitalism. The other fellow, Paul Dano, represents, you know, religion. So it's this great sort of big story. The problem is it does kind of reduce some of the characters, I think, to caricatures, and I think by the end they become almost too symbolic for me. I think that the last scene, which is somewhat problematic, and I think people have said over the top, turned it more into a Greek tragedy to the point where you think that these people aren't even real any longer. But nonetheless, I thought it was terrific. And by the way, I was just reading an Entertainment Weekly that said Daniel Day-Lewis's insult to Paul Dano, saying, "I drink your milkshake," which is a way of sort of talking about how he's sucking out the oil from under his land, has become this sort of common Hollywood epithet now. You know, "I drink your milkshake."
If you have a straw,
I was wondering which one of us.
Right. Yeah. And you have a milkshake, I drink your milkshake.
That's right. You need to do your John Huston imitation.
I was blown away by that scene. Dick Blake also thought it might have been a little over the top. I didn't think so. I was totally wrapped up in it. I love Daniel Day-Lewis, and I thought, you know, he had sort of held back for much of the film, and then he just sort of let it out in that last scene. And
Do you think it was realistic? My only thing was, I thought, well, okay, he's crazy, so maybe this is why he's acting like that. But it just seems so out of character for this guy who had been so sedate.
Yeah, but I mean, it had sort of built to a point. Mm-hmm. We were at a period, you know.
Well, it's like an oil. It's like gusher going off.
Exactly. And I'm not sure if I describe him as sedate. I mean, there are scenes in which he's just about to go off.
That's true.
I mean, he doesn't mm-hmm. burst, but mm-hmm. he's just about to. The scene where he's baptized, for example.
Right, that's terrific.
But Bill, what was your take on it?
I haven't seen it.
You've seen it.
I've seen it twice, and I probably have to hold myself back on this movie because I am a huge fan of this movie. It's one of my favorite movies I've
don't
seen
hold back
in a long time. No, I really mean it. It for all the reasons that Jim mentioned, and I agree with most of what he said, there's something about Paul Thomas Anderson, who also directed Magnolia, that's Old Testament in his vision.
Mm-hmm. Even the names
absolutely.
Of the characters.
No, the characters are, you know, Eli and Abel and Daniel.
Paul,
and beyond that, but beyond that, just in his the scope of what he likes to talk mm-hmm. about, there's something. Even though it's not talking, you know, as much as it's about the oil business, it's not, and as much as it's about religion, it's not. I'm amazed. I saw it the second time not too long ago. I'm amazed that people actually had a problem with the final scene, because to me, the final scene is what is so brilliant. And I don't want to give anything away, but the preacher character has a church called the Church of the Third Revelation. And Daniel Day-Lewis, Daniel Plainview's character at the end, is confronting him, and he says, "I am the third revelation." And it's a brilliant scene, I thought, and it also, to me, encapsulates so much of what this is about and so much of what I think Paul Thomas Anderson is kind of getting at. We have the third revelation. We have the Old Testament, the New Testament, and then American industry, the quintessentially American mm-hmm. success story to a certain extent. The man who masters the universe, masters his fate, and loses all in some ways. I don't want to give it away, but it is sort of like Citizen Kane without the rosebud. It's like he's Captain Ahab, you know. You know, it is a very mannered sort of performance, but I think great. And I just, I couldn't say enough good things about it. It's one of my favorite movies I've seen in a long time.
The only problem is I do find that, by the way, a little point of interest for our any Jesuit fans out there, the home that he moves into towards the end of the movie is actually the St. Ignatius Retreat House in Manhasset, Long Island. That's so right. I saw with the Jesuit, and I said, that's interesting. He made all of his money in California oil and bought a Jesuit retreat house and moved into it, which were apparently had a bowling alley in the basement as well. I agree with you. I guess I found that at the beginning, he is a real character. These people are real characters. The preacher, you know, him, the oil man, he's a real person. He has kids. He has, you know, angers. And then by the end, he becomes, to me, to my mind, sort of just a symbol. But I still, you're right, I still think it's a masterpiece. But you could say the same thing about Citizen Kane. He becomes a kind of symbol.
Or even Moby Dick. I mean, that's the thing. These epic American.
That's the one about the whale.
Right, yeah.
No. It's about the musician. You know, one of the things I did want to say, sort of relating back to my Tommy Lee Jones character as well, or comment earlier, the thing about Daniel Day-Lewis on the second time through that cracked me up is at a certain point, he just, there's some shots of him in this movie, and so much of it is non-spoken. There's so, in some ways, dialogue is not that important to this film. He looks just like the embodiment of the American spirit, the American West, the American drive. And I know he's not an American actor, but he does it brilliantly.
Yeah.
And it's like there's some shots. It's like, my gosh, this is a Western. It's a Western in the sense that America, after the West was tamed, the next frontier is capitalism on a certain level. And in all its glories and all of its degradations or in all of its lacking as well. And he's like a modern day gunslinger. He's like the same way Ross Perot was the modern day, I thought, in some ways, the modern day cowboy.
Now, there was a cover story about the movie and about Daniel Day-Lewis in the Times Magazine 2 or 3 months ago. Yeah. And that's worth looking at because he is fascinated with American culture, specifically Westerns. And growing up in a English, he was the son of Cecil Day-Lewis, who was a poet, was the poet laureate in England. So he came from this culture. He was in these Shakespearean plays that was very articulate and well-spoken. Right. And there was something about the American actors like Robert De Niro when everything was unspoken, you know, films like Taxi Driver, where it was all about reticence. And he's obviously learned a lot from that because in this film, he doesn't say a lot, but, you know, there's a lot there.
And it's such an American thing. I think that's why a lot of the world looks at these things and maybe has an attraction to it. And I will say, as much as he's a complicated and dark character, there's a part of you, at least for me, that really identifies with a lot of what he's about. And when he's up against Standard Oil and he's fighting these things, it's like you're rooting for him.
You know, but he's also very he is the embodiment of capitalism. He is the original self-made man. I mean, you know, as a number of critics have said, you know, you see him, you know, literally coming out of the ground, you know, newly born. He comes out of the ground. And I think there's a great, I think Paul Thomas Anderson does a great job of, in some very quick brushstrokes, within about 10 minutes, he takes you through about 10, 15 years of this guy's life, or so it seems, in terms of building his industry.
His
you
empire.
See the derrick's getting bigger and bigger. You see him moving to bigger towns. And it's really brilliant with a real sort of economy of scale and of film. I also think it's interesting that, you know, you have Daniel Day-Lewis, who was sort of this handsome young leading man, is now become, he's a 50-year-old guy.
Yeah.
And he's sort of playing, he's playing the Walter, the John Huston role, which I think is fascinating.
Very Catholic, too. A friend of mine in L.A. pointed out a film, a scriptwriter out there said he saw that movie and he's like, Paul Thomas Anderson, I believe, has some Catholic background, and he saw Altman and I haven't thought of this much about it, but Altman, who also was raised Catholic on a certain level, this very long shots is considered by some screenwriters to be or cinematographers to be very somewhat of a Catholic view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's just reality. We're not going to cut it up. We're going to show you. And there is something, you know, which I hadn't really thought about as much, but my friend brought up that he thinks Paul Thomas Anderson can't help but see a real deeply Catholic influence in his imagination.
Well, a friend of mine who writes for America Magazine from time to time, Richard Leonard, who's an Australian film critic, his dissertation was on, you know, you have the feminist gaze, how that's looked at in cinema. He has something on the gaze of the mystic, the mystical look in cinema. And he talks about Peter Weir. One of the things he talks about is that these long shots are seen as mystical because they're kind of godlike. I mean, it's a sense of, for those people sort of familiar with Ignatian spirituality, it's sort of the sense of God kind of looking down on the world. And so there's a lot of that in actually both of these movies, I think, in No Country for Old Men and also There Will Be Blood, this kind of, you know, just sort of taking it all in as God would.
You're right.
Now, we could talk about There Will Be Blood, I think, for a long time. But
I know we kind of went on, but it's really worth seeing.
Great film. And now we're going to jump to our last film, Atonement, and we're going to ask Father Jim to give us a description of the film first.
Well, actually, Atonement is, because I haven't seen it, but I know what the book's about. Atonement is, that's right. I read enough reviews, and I also read the book. Atonement is a...
don't give away the ending.
I won't give away the ending. It's a drama that takes place essentially between two people that's based on sort of a horrible misunderstanding and a horrible lie, and how it kind of infects both people's lives. From what I understand from everything that I've read, the movie is, Dick Blake called it sort of a noble failure.
Yes.
And I've heard that it's very sort of pretty, but it doesn't have the power of the book. The power of the book was quite impressive.
Yes.
So I defer to people who have actually seen it.
Yeah. Bill, you saw the film.
I've actually
I did
it.
Too, but you go first.
Okay. I will say that I think Jim had probably the better of the experience by reading the book, because to be quite honest, I was underwhelmed by the movie. I mean... I kept thinking, boy, there must be a lot more in this book, because I feel like I'm missing huge swaths of what's supposed to be happening here, and some psychology of the characters, and also some action. To me, it didn't strike me. It's a well done movie, but it didn't strike me as anywhere near on the same plane as No Country for Old Men or There Will Be Blood, or even in some ways Michael Clayton. You know, I thought it was a good movie, but not a great movie.
No, yes, I would agree with all those things. I read the book, and I would recommend to anyone to read the book before you see the movie, because it's much more powerful. But, I mean, there's some interesting ideas he's exploring here, including, you know, how do you atone for mistakes you've made, for sins you've committed? And that's what happens. Somebody misinterprets an event, a young person misinterprets an event at the beginning of the film, and it has these repercussions that really there's nothing they can do about it.
Right.
And that's what the film explores. And so it's worth seeing and reading the book, certainly, to explore this. But and there's some good performances. You know, Keira Knightley, I think, is good, and the other fellow, James McAvoy. But in the end, I couldn't but help thinking of the novel, which I won't give it away, but it is sort of breathtaking.
Do you think it was – I mean, the complaint I heard was that it was sort of too glossy, too pretty, and, you know, a lot of sort of set design and
– Well, that's been the criticism of particularly that one shot. The movie –
It's a big tracking shot.
There's this big tracking shot. The movie that with sort of the culmination of this long trip that one of the male character is in World War II, and he's heading back to England during Dunkirk, you know, the failed invasion. And there's this shot of the beach at Dunkirk, and it is this long tracking shot that's like probably 3 or 4 minutes long. And I didn't find it quite as vulgar as some. But
well, some people said, rather than thinking, wow, this is, you know, Dunkirk is quite an experience, this guy's in the middle of it, you think, wow, what a great tracking shot.
Yeah, you are
sort
of distracted by the technique.
You know, I mean, you think of something like Saving Private Ryan, and I've seen many times, I think it's terrific. You don't get that sense. I mean, you know, Spielberg puts you in there, and you don't get a sense of, wow, he's really technically proficient, which of course he is. You just are able to surrender that and kind of enter into it. But the critique I heard was that this is less, that's less likely in this movie.
Yeah, I certainly was aware of it, and I had read the reviews, so I was like waiting for it. So that was sort of distracting. Unlike, say, that famous shot in Goodfellas, which I think it's sort of modeled after, where he's going into the Copacabana through the back door and through the kitchen. And when I first saw that, I don't remember thinking, oh my gosh, this is a really long tracking shot. I just remember just being totally, you know, caught up in it.
Although that's one of the difficulties of reading a review before you go in, because now I do see Goodfellas and I say, here comes the big tracking shot for 9 minutes or whatever it is. And I think, unfortunately, you would probably be upset to be the director and have this everyone know, you know, here's this thing that you're going to be expecting. And it's harder for you to kind of suspend your disbelief.
And one of the things about the book, I maybe want to read the book, and it made me feel like it would be difficult to translate the film, was you're right. And on its face, it would, from of all the movies we were talking about, should have a lot of in-depth things to say, or important, interesting things to say about the notion of forgiveness, the notion of atonement. And yet I felt like the book must have played with time much more convincingly than the movie was able to.
Yeah.
Because by the end of it, I was like, I felt like, boy, this is a story that was clearly better told in a book.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't translate as well to film.
And as good as Vanessa Redgrave is at the end, I did feel kind of like pulled out of the film when she appears. You're like, what's going on? So you're in this period film, and then suddenly you're, you know, in 1995 London or whatever.
Exactly.
And Juno shows up and it's very surprising.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's the five
and
films.
He drinks her milkshake.
We're going to end by going, each of us is going to pick what we think will win the Oscar and what we think should win the Oscar. So, Father Jim, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think Atonement is the kind of movie, as I say, the Academy likes, but I think there has been so much critique of it that it won't win. I think Juno's a little too edgy. I think Michael Clayton's a little too bland. I mean, it's a great movie, but it's sort of the same old, you know, corporate whatever. For to win an Oscar, I think No Country for Old Men will win, because I think people like the Coen brothers. I think great performances by Tommy Lee Jones. It's an arty movie that's accessible to most people. And I think what should win is There Will Be Blood. But I think that it might be a little too artistic, you know, for voters. But who knows? So I think it's between those two.
I have a lot of feelings. I mean, to me, what should win, there's no doubt to me, is There Will Be Blood. Again, I said one of my favorite movies for a long time. What will win is another case altogether. I think Jim makes a good point about how No Country for Old Men might be a favorite. Although I was talking to the friend of mine now, that if you're dropping Dick Leonard's name, I'm going to have to drop another name. Bobby Fischer, a good buddy of mine, chess champion. No,
he's chess champion.
No, Bob Fischer, the reason I would say this is I don't want to take credit for his idea because he mentioned it to me the other day. He's the screenwriter I was talking about who surprisingly wrote that movie, Wedding Crashers, who a lot of your listeners might be surprised to know. Bob Fischer, who wrote Wedding Crashers, or co-wrote it, is very interested in, he's Catholic and very interested in Catholic things. And we talked about it. He said he had a good point I hadn't thought about, that he thinks the Academy could easily split themselves on There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men, and that Juno could somehow...
Well, you're stealing my thunder here.
Oh, I don't mean to. I'm sorry about that. But I mean, like, I hadn't thought about it that way, that Juno could somehow win as this weird dark horse, which I think would be unfortunate. But, you know, awards are... How important are they, really? But thanks to Bob Fischer for stealing his idea.
Well, I'm going to go, since you both picked There Will Be Blood, I'm going to say that
No Country for Old Men.
And in terms of the one that you think should win, right?
Oh, really? Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right.
I don't listen.
You don't. I love There Will Be Blood, too, but I'm going to say I think Michael Clayton should win it. I mean, I think it's just a well-done Hollywood movie, you know? I mean, I think it doesn't have sort of the epic reach of these other films, although it does... it does talk about bigger issues in a way that's very compelling. It's just good filmmaking. So I would say that's what I think should win, but I don't think it's going to win. And I for the same reasons that your friend listed, I think Juno's going to win because I think the vote for the bleaker films is going to be split among No Country for Old Blood, There Will Be Blood, and even Michael Clayton.
Michael Clayton, right.
So those three films I think are going to split a lot of the votes. And then in this year of these dark films, people are going to say, okay, enough with that. Let's go with something that's a little lighter.
Although I wonder if some of the older voters are going to like Juno. So my fear is that those things get split and Atonement wins. I mean, it really is. It's a very sort of generic, sort of splashy, glossy movie that I haven't seen.
Well, but if some of the older voters might be sort of taken in by this sense that Juno is sort of an indie hip movie and might want to vote for it.
Exactly.
In that sense, when I think would be a bit of a miss.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is not to forget is that a lot of times they won't vote for, like, Ivan Reitman, I guess, is a fairly new director, and Ellen Page and Michael Cera, and they won't vote for these sort of new people. They'll say, well, you know, they have plenty
of time.
So we're going to vote for the Coen brothers and Tommy Lee
Jones.
It's
very likely that'll win for best, like, original screenplay, and then it won't get anything
else. Best pro-life movie.
Yeah.
But I have to say, at the end of the day, I really don't worry about any of this.
So I will, after the Oscars airs, maybe on our next episode, I will recap our choices and see which one of us won, or if any of us won. So
now make sure to change them. And make to
Tom Wright, can I come back
on
and gloat?
You can.
Because that's something I like to do a lot.
Bill McGarvey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Father Jim Martin, and hopefully you both can come back maybe next year, and we'll do this again.
Terrific.
Send people to BustedHalo.com, Tim.
Please. Yes, BustedHalo.com, the website that Bill runs, and Father Jim Martin, of course, blogger here at America. So thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon. I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Hope you enjoyed our recap of the Best Picture nominees. And again, this will be posted on Wednesday of this week, so that's February 20th, so that you'll have a few days before the Oscars to listen to this. But we will let you know next week who won and how we fared in our predictions. And again, you can subscribe to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.